Welcome to the Azure Podcast, a weekly podcast to keep you up to date on what's new on our cloud platform, Microsoft Azure. Your hosts, Cynthia Crane, Evan Basilik, Suji DeMello, Kendall Roden, Kel Teeter, and Russell Young discuss a different service or solution on each show, with subject matter experts to explain how to get started, how different services work, and how to make decisions in tricky scenarios. You can find out more about our podcast at azpodcast.com or follow us on Twitter at Azure Podcast.
Well, welcome back to the Azure Podcast. This is episode number 398, being recorded on the 15th of October, 2021. Today on Teams with me, I have Evan and myself, and we're going to spend the episode talking about the plethora of news in the Azure space that just came out. I mean, it's kind of unusual, right, Evan? I mean, like, it just seemed like last week there was just flood of
don't we have a conference coming up soon, I think?
What is it?
Is it Inspire? I can't remember. They a bunch of them have changed names, and then we merged some, and I've sort of lost track, but I suspect it's an element of that. Plus, everybody comes back from the summer. Devs are happy to write code. You know, I'm sure there's some element of that. But yeah, we sort of got overrun with news this week, so we thought it would be fun to spend the time doing that and just sort of catching up on some stuff.
Absolutely, yeah. Now, I know there were a few that you liked in particular. Would you like to start with one, and then we can go back and forth on that?
Yeah. And I sort of laugh at this one because, you know, you don't think about us trying to save you money, save customers money. But, you know, if you're running, SQL Server on a VM, you can actually take advantage of the hybrid benefit. So leverage the licenses that you've bought for on-premises or that you used to run on-premises and use those in Azure. And the way of managing that historically was a little bit complicated. Now we've elevated that to, you can do it at a, an Azure subscription level and sort of assign those licenses out. It's still in preview, so, it'll change a little bit over time, but a much, much easier way to manage that. And at the end of the day, if you have those licenses, and we have a similar thing for Windows too, absolutely use them, right? I mean, yeah. I don't know the numbers for SQL, but I think for a Windows VM, it cuts it down to like you save like 40% off the VM cost if you're leveraging the Windows licenses you already own. Wow. Right. So we basically don't want to double charge you, right? There's no intent to do that. So yeah, definitely check out that that new experience.
Great. So there's been a lot of news in the AKS Kubernetes space this past week. And so I'll start with one of them. And this is related to the Azure Arc for Kubernetes. And just as a refresher, that is the facility where customers can run Kubernetes within their own environments, in their own data centers, in their own clouds, and still manage it in a central place, like in the Azure portal. And this way they can ensure that, the right compliance is applied to all of their Kubernetes clusters and they have the right logging of information from there. And what's now added is the ability to do container insights. If you recall, container insights is more like this Kubernetes aware style of monitoring available in AKS.
Azure Monitor at that point, or
this actually gets deployed inside. So obviously, a component has to be deployed inside of the customer's Kubernetes.
Okay.
Because it has to pull out all of the container level details. In the past, it was just logs that were being sent.
Oh,
now it's,
gotcha.
Now it's okay. More than just logs. It can try and tell you, the pods that are there, the namespaces that you created, and things like that, right? What kind of controllers you have defined in Kubernetes in your thing, and then surface that in that view. We have that nice view for AKS today, and now they've extended that view, that container insights view for a Kubernetes that's hosted in the customer's premises via Azure Arc.
Oh, so, that's what I was going to say. So this is more of the Arc enablement stuff at that. That actually... and I know you've got some other AKS stuff, but while we're on the subject of Azure Arc, Arc is really showing up everywhere now. Now you can do hybrid workers for Azure Automation using Azure Arc and put these in your on-premises servers or even really any server that is running Arc. right? So it's really interesting to see these sort of enablement that ARC does. It's really extending. I don't know whether it's, you could say it's merging the on-premises data center and the cloud, because we've always had that hybrid concept, but it is absolutely pushing that cloud management back on premises in a lot of different ways. It's really kind of neat to see that grow.
Yeah. I mean, and this is especially good for customers that are reluctant to move to the cloud all in just
or
yet.
Or can't for some regulatory reason or whatever the case. Yeah, exactly.
So, but this is a good stepping stone for them to get some of it, some visibility in the cloud. And then as they get more comfortable, the idea is that they will say, oh, everything looks pretty good. The security is top notch. You know, let's try moving this one workload. And then, you know, they'll take baby steps to do that. But this is always a first step, Azure Arc.
Yeah, no, great. Cool. Well, what else is going on in AKS land?
So in the AKS land, let's see, let me just go here. Yeah. So, we've always supported IPv4 in AKS, and most of our Azure services support, of course, that's out of the box. But IPv6, as you know, Evan, has been something that customers are interested in, because IPv4, the address space sometimes is not enough for them, or they have a large enough network where they need, you know, IPv6, or maybe they just have a lot of devices that now support IPv6 and they want to have that facility available in their clusters. And so now in AKS, in KubeNet, you can overlay IPv6 as well, you can support IPv6 native addressing in KubeNet. Again, this is the KubeNet, which is the the in network cluster in the cluster network in AKS.
Sort of the NATing infrastructure inside of the AKS. Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. And I'll let you go for one or two, and then I'll come back to some of the others that I have. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So this one's actually not sort of a new release, but this caught my attention the other day. Earlier this year, and we'll include a link to the article. But we had the largest DDoS attack ever across the internet, targeted at Azure this summer, and it was 2.4 terabytes a second. Wow. Now, the previous largest was 2.3, so it's not a whole lot higher. But even still, I mean, those are just scary, amazing numbers. And obviously, Azure and the other cloud providers, right, are scaled because we know this is going to happen. We know it's going to come at some point. And so we're, our DDoS infrastructures are scaled to be able to handle that. But I mean, again, obviously I'm very pro cloud, but can you imagine an on-premises environment that would be able to handle that? It just can't, right? So it's really good. I mean, it's sort of depressing in the sense of where the bad actors have gone in terms of their capabilities, because they're really smart people too, unfortunately. But it's just the scale at which some of this stuff happens is just, I mean, amazing. I mean, I I'm going to have to look it up because I don't remember how many megabytes are in a terabyte. I mean, is it 1,000 or 10,000?
It's 1,000, right?
I think you're right. So it's 1,000 squared. And I mean, I'm thrilled that I have 400 meg down at my house. I can't forget it. This would take me down in a fraction of a second, right? I wouldn't even survive. So, we'll include the article, but it's just, it's really interesting to see the capabilities of these cloud providers to withstand that stuff.
And I know this is maybe a little bit off topic, but I can't imagine with someone to produce that much traffic, you would think that they would need another cloud to do that, right? Because how do you even generate so much traffic?
They almost do. I mean, they have all these, I mean, a lot of times, and I don't remember the scale it was, but, a couple, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, the biggest at the time was somebody had, I think they had created this big botnet of a bunch of, was it routers or video cameras? This sort of goes back to this IPv4, IPv6 thing, but every device now these days is online. And one of the unfortunate realities of a lot of these devices is they don't get updated. Either the manufacturer doesn't update them and I sort of get it. Consumers don't necessarily know how to do this stuff. The customer, the end consumer doesn't update it. And now, if there's a attack vector, somebody takes over that device, they're using these basically bought networks of IoT networks to go after, you know, somebody that's running somewhere. But you're right. I mean, it sort of goes back to what I said, that like the bad folks are very smart to figure out how to do this, and they're leveraging this stuff in targeted fashion, and the scale just continues to grow. I mean, what is it? Billions of IoT devices coming online over the next right. few years. It's just going to get bigger.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's definitely a good one. Again, back on the AKS bandwagon, you know, an AKS is basically Microsoft's, I guess, cloud version of Kubernetes, right, is the best way to describe it. And so when they release their they're considered a cloud provider at that point in time. And so when they release a version of AKS, it has to follow the base Kubernetes release, right? So Kubernetes is an open source platform, mm-hmm. as we all know. And that, you know, that is going through its, you know, daily updates. And at some point they take a cut of that, and then they, you know, they do the cloud specific version of it. The cloud provider will release a version that follows that Kubernetes version, and that's called in tree. So the base tree is Kubernetes, and then the cloud provider is
basically pulling it over to your fork in essence. Correct. At that point. Okay.
Exactly. But now there's a new option where you can go out of tree. So the cloud provider can start making updates that are not yet in the base Kubernetes. And this may be, for example, if there's a security update or something that has to be rapidly deployed, and it, you know, through the community system, it takes a while for that mm-hmm. to roll into the base Kubernetes before the cloud provider can get it. The cloud provider can be a little bit ahead of where the base, you know, the base Kubernetes tree is. And so this is a new feature in AKS, which you can opt into, and then you can decide, you know, whether you want to go into that updated newer version, which the cloud provider has provided you. And this applies to all clouds, not just Azure. So, you know, even Amazon and Google and others also leverage that feature.
So this is a Kubernetes capability that the cloud provider has to enable, you know, obviously. But is the thinking that, so you go out of tree, I assume the typical behavior would be at some point you come back in tree, because you're sort of back to mainline. Like, so it's sort of, it's like the typical branching and forking that you see, right? You're going out for a very specific reason.
And later on, you kind of sync up back with the main tree. Okay. Yeah. If you want to, but you kind of have that control now, that knob that you can control inside of AKS as to which version you want to be on.
Okay. Great.
And then one more on the AKS. Again, like I said, there were a lot of AKS updates this
and Kendall
this
past
week.
Missed it today, right?
I know. Too bad Kendall's not here. She'd be all over this. but I don't know if you heard about WebAssembly. This is a new new format. You've heard of Blazor, which is a new way of executing applications that run in the browser. And Blazor uses this feature called WebAssembly, which is a platform independent executable language format, right? So you get, just today we have things like EXEs in Windows, and then you have Linux applications or whatever on Linux or Mac for that matter. But WebAssembly is a executable format that runs independently on all. Okay, it actually runs
like JavaScript conceptually.
Conceptually, okay. But at a much lower level. You know, it really defines like what the machine language would be like across all of these. And so, running WebAssembly.
The assembly piece that just sunk in. Okay, yeah. Gotcha.
and what WebAssembly actually does, it creates this sandbox for you to run, right? So it's a very protected environment. Once you run WebAssembly, nobody else can muck with it. And it does a lot of things what containers do today.
Yep.
Think about it. That's why people love containers, is that, you know, it runs in the sandbox. WebAssembly also does the same thing. So it would be nice to have run WebAssembly inside of your AKS cluster, because the AKS clusters run containers today. Yep. But why not run WebAssembly? Because WebAssembly has the same protection for applications, you know, kind of sandboxing them. And so that's what they have released a preview of. Today in AKS, you use something called a kubelet. A kubelet is what runs your containers in AKS. And it's a Kubernetes, it's a component of Kubernetes, but that's what runs containers inside of your Kubernetes cluster today. Now they have introduced something called a crustlet. Instead of a kubelet, they call it a crustlet. And a crustlet lets you run WebAssembly executables inside of your Kubernetes cluster and AKS cluster.
So I've got my cluster, and then in my cluster, I'm running these nodes. On my nodes, I'm running WebAssembly that is hosting containers. Is that the
no?
Or is it
instead
containers?
Of containers? You don't use
containers. Containers.
Because
okay.
That's why the WebAssembly is already a sort of pseudo containerized system, right? There's no need to have yet another container on top of that or underneath that. It already has the same protections of containers. You know, it basically encapsulates your application.
So it becomes sort of a slimmer thing because now I don't have to run the container. I can just run that XE and it handles whatever I need to inside of that.
And it's platform agnostic, so you could have Windows Kubernetes or a Mac Kubernetes or Linux Kubernetes or whatever, and it was still you'd be able to run the same the same executable everywhere. So I think it does open up those possibilities.
Yeah. Do I need to recompile my XE to run it in WebAssembly? I mean,
the WebAssembly. You have to create a WebAssembly. You have to generate a WebAssembly, and that you can do that with .NET. I know. I don't know about the other languages, but it's certainly C# and .NET. I have a bunch of WebBlazer apps, for example, written in .NET, and they just run in the browser. Right? It's very cool. It just compiles and it runs as I guess under the covers. It sort of executes it. There's a little runtime that runs in the browser that will run your WebAssembly. And that's becoming a standard in browsers now. So all the browsers support WebAssembly today, I think, all the major browsers. So similar to that, the Kubernetes cluster also wants to be in a place where they can also support WebAssembly in executables.
So you and I were talking before the show, even though I came out of developer support these days, I hardly ever get to actually write code. How do I know whether I should be doing JavaScript or Blazor, or this WebAssembly? Like, what is the, is there a reasonably straightforward decision tree there, or is it just sort of up to your preference at that point?
Yeah, a lot of the preferences for languages or platforms, if you're in a large company, for example, will be dictated by what is the general skill set within the company. Mm-hmm. What their security and compliance people have approved. So sometimes it's limited to that. But if you didn't have those restrictions, the JavaScript, I believe now is I think it's starting to get a little bit out of favor, if you ask me. I think doing things like WebAssembly is becoming more, it's a more modern way of building applications, because JavaScript was never really meant for building the kind of apps we have today running on JavaScript. Right. People have, basically abused it to the nth degree and brought it to where it is, which is amazing in its own right. But it was due for a complete refresh. I think they tried to reboot JavaScript with the ECMA 6 standard in HTML and whatnot. But I'm not sure how far that went. I think the WebAssembly seems to be more in favor with developers, at least from the front end style developer.
Right.
But WebAssembly can also be used for back end stuff. I mean, that's the thing. It does both the front end and the back end related to the front end. So the front end talks to a back end component, which is also written in WebAssembly.
Yeah, it's interesting when you describe that. What I sort of hear is sort of like HTML5 was, a way to standardize and push more and more stuff into the browser. And even honestly, the Chrome browser being open sourced and, Microsoft Edge these days is based on Chrome. It's all about sort of this portability drives a lot of this, but the underlying, sort of platform on which everybody is running needed that work. I mean, the browser has become a standard in some ways, and Kubernetes in another way. But the old, when we talk about JavaScript, it's been around forever. And so I guess some of this stuff had to just get sort of rewritten from scratch to say, hey, this is leveraging sort of a modern stack at that point. Okay. Hey, maybe there's hope for me. I might be able to write a web app again. I've lost that skill over the years. And every time I look at JavaScript, I just go, oh, and so I may have to come back and look at some of this. That's cool.
Yeah, no, that's a good question. And then one more I'll cover in AKS and I'll hand the reins back to you. So one of the challenges of deploying AKS in a constrained corporate environment has always been that corporate environments are typically blocked off from the internet via proxy servers. And so if you just go to install AKS, in your Azure. The Azure is the Azure VNet is normally bound via Express Route back to some sort of a proxy server on premises, and that goes out to the internet. And you know, the actual installation of the cluster is not aware of that route, because you know it's expecting a more direct route to be able to pull images that it requires to install AKS, and you know, pull all the required artifacts, you know, things like certificate files and things like that. And so now they've made it a configuration option in the AZCLI command for AKS, where you can specify, hey, I want to use this proxy server, you know, to install my AKS. And so this way, when it actually goes to deploy it in your VNet, it knows that it has to use that proxy server to pull down required images or, you know, whatever other artifacts on the internet, just to bootstrap the cluster. Once the cluster is up and running and you put your applications on top of that, your applications can be configured to use the proxy server. That's been there traditionally. You know, there's ways you can set environment variables to tell the applications to use your proxy server. But this is just the installation of AKS in your VNet has been a challenge. And it's typically meant, temporarily opening up ports for a few seconds, do the installation and shut it down, something like that, something funky like that, you know. So I believe that's that update is something that a lot of our customers are going to be very happy to see.
Okay. Yeah, so you know, along that networking vein, you know, we just you know, GA'd the service tag discovery API, which is, you know, sort of a lot of words to say this is a REST API that you can use to go find out what IPs are associated with what Microsoft services. This is beyond just Azure. This includes you know, 365 in it as well, and you know, what data center they're assigned to, which services you can. You know, when you go into your VNet, and I assume there's one for AKS, you know, but you can say, hey, I want to allow just the necessary control plane ports for AKS. And you can, you know, basically use a tag to figure that out. You can call into the tag and figure out the IPs that are underneath it. You know, this has been around. This used to be an old XML file that you would download. And there was a couple of different parsing, you know, things. I wrote a service at one point that parsed this stuff. And you know, this now it's a, you know, fully supported GA API that uses REST to get this stuff, which is great. It's been around for a while. It's been in public preview for a while, but it's finally gone GA. This just makes life a lot easier. Especially like the really common one I used to see is firewalls and NVAs. You know, you have to say which ports to allow. And you know, people were having to write these automated jobs that would wake up every so often and you know, parse the file and everything else. And now they just make the REST API calls. It just gets a lot easier.
Yeah, I remember doing that with some customers where they had to, they had special scripts and whatnot that would parse this every day.
Yeah, and heaven forbid that script doesn't run and you miss an IP or something, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Stuff breaks.
That's a good one, yeah. There's been a couple of updates on Azure Machine Learning, and just coincidentally, I was doing a small Azure Machine Learning project a couple of weeks ago, and it's something we don't talk about enough, I think, on the show. But that is just one of the gems of Azure. I've been telling all of my friends and colleagues that, you know, no matter what you do, right, you may not even be in technology. You may be in finance, you may be in manufacturing, any business that you're in, accounting. You can improve your business by using Azure Machine Learning. It doesn't require any technical skills to use it. It requires just a little bit of understanding of data, which most of us have, no matter what business we're in or what line of business we're in. And, you know, you could just quickly, you know, throw some data at it, and ask it to figure out, you know, what kind of algorithm to use. It will go and try all of the algorithms that it knows about and will tell you this is the best algorithm for what you want to do. And then once you've selected that algorithm, you can expose it as a web service and make it available to everybody in your company. And this is something that, you know, I think people have always wanted to do. It will help you improve your business processes, your work, the jobs that you do every day manually, right? Every day you may be doing this stuff manually, and now you can quickly automate some of this stuff. So you know, in that, one of the things that Azure Machine Learning has done is now they are now available in the West US 3 region. And this is one of those new regions that we talked about, which popped up a few months ago. It's been available there. But along with that, they've also released a slew of updates to Azure Machine Learning, which are interesting. One of them relates to manage identities, because Azure Machine Learning typically needs access to compute to actually run the jobs, to run all your training and your inference. And the compute needs access to things like Key Vault or storage or your ACR to pull down images. And it's, you know, managing those identities in all of those cases has been tricky. The concept of managed identities does not exist. And so now by using managed identities, you know, it's a much more secure way where you could allow that access, you know, from the VM to the ACR to the Key Vault, et cetera. So that's, a feature that our customers would really look forward to. The other one is, you know, as I said, when Azure ML, you can create a drag and drop, almost like a visual markup of how you want to run your process or your training or your execution of your Azure Machine Learning workload. And one of the things they've added now is called a parallel run step. So this way you could do multiple things at the same time. Earlier it used to be you do this step, then you do that step, then it was kind of more like sequential.
Okay. Yeah.
So with a parallel step, you can train a model in different ways or something all at the same time, or just speed up your execution. Of course, you know, you will use up more compute during that time, but it will help speed up some of that execution. And so that's one thing that they've added. And the third thing that they've added is, you know, in order to, like I said, you create these compute environments inside of Azure Machine Learning to maybe you have a GPU environment or something, you know, to do things faster. It's been really tricky to do that through the Azure CLI. That's been very difficult. You normally have to go into the Azure Machine Learning workspace and do it from there. Now they've made a lot of improvements in the Azure Machine, in the AZ CLI command to enable, you know, because corporates want to have more like a predictable way of creating these environments. And so using the AZ CLI, they can now do that in a more predictable way. So that's some of the updates that have been happening over there.
Yeah, that's cool. A couple, looping back around to SQL just a little bit. And this one actually it sounds small, but I've talked to a lot of customers that really want this, right? We're talking about managed identity. The beauty of that is you don't have to manage it. But the one thing that people do still want to manage is they want to control their own keys. One of the recent changes to SQL database and SQL managed instances is you can have the managed identity construct, but it actually manages your keys, but they're customer provided keys. Right. So instead of having to, you know, rely on a key that we Microsoft give you, you can now, you know, use your own managed keys. And again, at some level, you know, I get it. You don't want us necessarily managing some of this stuff for you because it is a secret. Again, doesn't mean we're not trustworthy. It's just that level of security that you want to apply. So that's a new feature for SQL database and managed instances. And then the other one, and this is for Azure database for PostgreSQL, which is private link on that. Again, sort of on the same security theme, which is now you're going to be going through or be able to access PostgreSQL instead of having to use a public, you know, an IP address that's in the public range. You can use a private one to connect up to it at that point. By the way, I didn't know this until I did an investigation with a customer who was migrating to PostgreSQL. That there's a lot of Oracle to Postgres migrations these days. Apparently, when you look at sort of the database world, Postgres is the one that's closest to Oracle in terms of T-SQL style and function style and the like. So that's, you know, obviously some people do migrate from Oracle to SQL, but the Oracle to Postgres is much, much easier. And now that Postgres is, you know, there's cloud variants out there, we see, you know, people doing that. Again, just a little tidbit, something I learned, you know, a couple months ago that I thought was neat. I did not know that. Anything else?
There's been a couple of quick ones. Maybe we can wrap up here on Azure Static Web Apps. One of them is about the IP based protection for static web apps. So if you have a static app, web app that you want to restrict to specific IP ranges, you can do that now.
Oh, so sources. Okay, gotcha.
Yeah, so that's kind of one level of security. I think we used to have that for PaaS, but not for the static web apps option. And the second one is, you know, in static web apps, once you get authenticated today, you can set up the automatic authentication or easy auth using Azure AD. But if you then, after that, want to assign custom claims or roles to the user, it was difficult, right? Because this whole idea of static web apps is there's no compute anywhere to do it. So where do you do the assignment of custom roles? And now you can connect an Azure function to that authorization step. So, you know, when it comes after the user is authenticated and the time and you need to assign specific roles, you can call connect it to an Azure function. That Azure function can look up, you know, your graph database or some Azure AD call to say, okay, these are the roles that belong to this user, and assign them along with the claims. And now, so when the user now starts executing code, you're doing it, you know exactly what that user can and cannot do in your app, right? You can maybe show sections of the app or hide sections of the app based on their permissions, or allow them to do certain functions based on their role. And so this is something I think, you know, just a natural enhancement of static web apps to get them to be more useful for a broad number of reasons.
The static web apps, they, you know, as I think about these, they're such a neat concept because it really says, I have all this content that's not going to change. But the reality is there is always some element of if then, you know, that you have to have in these apps. So by pairing this with functions, it's a really neat concept in my mind because it says, I want the, you know, I need this tiny, tiny, tiny little bit of compute, but I only want it when I want it, which functions do great. But now tying it with this static web app, and I think, you know, with static web apps, because of the way we do them, there's no compute charge associated with them. I think it's just storage, right? At the end of the day,
I mean that's the so there's a different kind of app for blob storage exposed as a static web app. This is the static web apps, which is supposed to come out of GitHub. So you create your app in GitHub, and then you connect the static web app to GitHub, so it automatically pulls all the latest changes from there. And that's your CI/CD, for the static component, the JavaScript and the HTML is pulled from from GitHub.
Storage location, basically, at that point. Yeah. Okay.
But at some point, you're going to have to call some backend API, and that backend API is going to be a function that's for your business logic. What we've added here is that even the authorization step now can also be connected to another Azure function so that it can assign you the proper roles before you start using your application. Gotcha. Then when you get it to your application, you can query those claims and see, okay, you know, this user can do this, can do that, whatnot, you know, things like that.
Yeah. Okay. Gone are the days when you stand up a server for a call that comes in once every 2 days, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
It's all cool. Serverless world now. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. No, that's a long list of stuff, Sajid.
Yes. I think it was well overdue having one of these sessions where we just cover all the news. We often fall behind and just cover tidbits of it in our regular shows.
I wouldn't even go with often. I would say we're always behind. There's way more than we can ever talk about.
Exactly. Yeah. But as you said, you know, I think it's Ignite, maybe that's coming up. So we'll do a show, I think, around that time. I'm sure that's going to have a whole bunch of updates being queued up for Ignite. So we'll have to do another show around that time.
I can't talk about them yet, but I've seen some of those. There's definitely a lot of stuff coming. So, okay.
All right.
Great. Evan. Always good. Always good to talk to you, Sajid. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to the show. If you have any thoughts, questions, or just want to connect, find us on Twitter at Azure Podcast. Background music has been taken from ccmixer.org under the Creative Commons license. We hope you'll tune in again soon to keep learning with us.